Okay, I will call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Monday, April 15th, 2024. Present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Co-Chair Representative Johnson, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Kronk, Representative Ortiz, Representative Cologne, myself, Co-Chair Foster, and Representative Galvin, and just a reminder, Representative Stapp also is with us. And just a reminder, if folks could mute their cell phones. We have two bills that we will be before us today. The first is House Bill 154. That is HFC's Green Bank bill. This bill was heard once last year. So we'll hear an updated presentation. Discuss the fiscal notes, set an amendment deadline, and then set the bill aside. The next bill we'll hear today is House Bill 223, that is tax and royalty for certain gas. We had the introductory hearing on this bill about a week ago, so we'll have a presentation from DNR. So first up is House Bill 154, that's HFC's Green Bank bill. Again, we heard that last year on May 5. And I'd like to ask Ike Galapsos, Deputy Director, Executive Director for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, to please come to the table, put yourself on the record. And also online, we have Mr. Curtis Thayer. He's the Executive Director for the Alaska Energy Authority. He'll speak to a couple slides. So feel free to kick it over to him whenever you're ready. So with that, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Foster. Is the audio coming through to your satisfaction?
I wonder if we could turn it up just a little bit. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, I'm Ike Galapsos, and I'm affiliated with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And on the phone, as you said, Mr. Chair, is also Mr. Curtis Thayer, who is the Executive Director for the Alaska Energy Authority. Also online, Mr. Chair, are our Chief Executive Officer and Executive Director, Mr. Brian Butcher, and Mr. Jimmy Ord, available for questions. Mr. Ord is our Director of the Research and Rural Development Department.
Great, thank you. I just want to also mention, for the record, we've got Representative Edgman, Co-Chair Edgman, with us also, and please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. We extend our thanks to the House Finance Committee for hearing Governor Dunleavy's bill that would establish a subsidiary nonprofit corporation under the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to focus on sustainable energy development. That has colloquially been called also a green bank. And so with your permission, Mr. Co-Chair, what I will do is proceed through the slide deck that we have that is meant to reaffirm the commitment of the corporation on this policy objective, update the committee members and the public on news that we have received from federal funding authorities in the time since we were last before this body in April of last year, and walk through the bill and fiscal analysis and answer any questions within my purview to do so.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. If I may direct the committee's attention, please, to slide four, moving ahead. Out of respect for time, not trying to rush in any way, but understanding there's another agenda item and we do not wish to belabor each slide. We'll pause at the end of each for questions, Mr. Chair. The policy objectives outlined in House Bill 154 are what we said earlier. By allowing the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to have the ability to create a subsidiary corporation that would focus on sustainable energy development, the state of Alaska would be empowering several affirmations from a policy trajectory. Firstly, the Housing Finance Corporation would be able to coordinate explicitly with the Alaska Energy Authority, which is the state energy office, and would be able to provide a level of technical and financial assistance on renewable energy projects and home improvements to individual Alaskans, homeownership organizations, collaborate with other nonprofit entities, be they utilities or local governments as well, to find the best way in which to reduce energy usage. We would also be able, from a temporal aspect, to magnetize some very time-limited tools that the federal government, the United States Congress, has afforded the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and by extension, the state of Alaska, notably individual and business tax credit opportunities, as well as certain grant opportunities that have been announced recently and will continue to be rolled out through the rest of calendar year of 2024. but also, Mr. Chair, this bill, if passed, would enable there to be an instrumental focal point by which all the actors who are concerned with energy conservation and being able to maximize the amount of energy efficiency would be able to collaborate in a way in which those complicated tools can be put to the best use for Alaskans. That concludes my remarks on this slide. I'm happy to proceed to the next slide, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
What we would like to show the committee, Mr. Chair, are some updates since we last spoke last year. Last year, when we were before this committee, the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which was enabled under congressional law that passed in 2022, had not yet gone through its formal notice process through the Environmental Protection Agency. And the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation had yet to have filed its application with the Alaska Energy Authority on one of the tranches of those funds. Since then, as early as the beginning of this month, the US EPA has announced an initial award of $14 billion from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, and also $6 billion to go to what's called the Clean Community Investment Accelerator. Now, those two tranches are specifically meant to go to a series of grantees. Those can be what we are called regional aggregators, who will work with local nonprofits, they can work with home ownership groups, they can work with tribal entities and other governments to be able to disseminate those funds. But what we are expecting from those funds is that they will not actually be dispersed, though the notice has gone out in this last month. The dollars themselves will not be on the street until the summer to fall of 2024 because of the negotiation process between the awardees and EPA. And this is timely because the corporation expects to be able to negotiate with some of those awardees on being able to be a potential recipient for part of those funds as well. Additionally, Mr. Co-Chair, at any point in this month, we will expect an announcement to come from the EPA on our application with the Alaska Energy Authority on what is called the Solar for All program that we will talk about in a later slide, but happy to do so if there's a question now. But additionally, there's a $7 billion tranche of capital that's made to be available before the end of September of this year. And that September deadline is because the congressional law was very explicit. The EPA is required to disperse the funds by the end of the federal fiscal year. And so we expect to see a pretty significant uptick in the interactivity between these grantees, local governments, and businesses between the spring of this year and the fall as well. Mr. Chair, that concludes my remarks on this slide. Going to slide six, Mr. Chair, one of the items that has kind of flown below the radar, which is understandable because funding sources like the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund are in the tens of billions of dollars, is the number of tools that green banks would be able to have in interacting with private partners, be they banks, credit unions, or nonprofit partners in the weatherization energy efficiency field. What this slide shows is what that interactivity can look like in a couple of different ways. One that we discussed last year was a waiver that the Department of Energy can give for when a community or a home ownership group would like to use what is called a non-novel form of renewable energy. What that essentially means is a technology that's already been proven that would allow the Department of Energy to then back that loan. So, for example, if a small village wanted to do an in-river tidal, in-river hydro, for example, because that has been a proven technology, they would not be eligible for that Department of Energy loan guarantee. But if they were financed through a green bank entity, such as our energy subsidiary, which would be designated as a State Energy Finance Institute, the acronym sometimes is called a SEFI, then that allows for that loan guarantee, which allows for proven technologies to lower the energy usage in communities to be de-risked, and by extension, the financing cost to be lowered, which by extension means the monthly cost to ratepayers to be lowered as a result of that. As well as that, Mr. Chair, we met 2 weeks ago with officials from the United States Department of Treasury about the interaction of the individual tax credits that are scheduled to expire in 2032 but will be valid through the duration of this decade, absent intervention from any forthcoming Congress. And what we mean specifically by that, Mr. Chair, is a concrete example, is that we have a forthcoming home energy rebate and a forthcoming home energy and electric appliance rebate program. It is somewhat similar to the state home energy program that this legislature appropriated between 2008 and 16, but the award amounts are significantly less. And the reason why that matters is that in order for some of these projects for homeowners to pencil, they are going to need to have that rebate program occur in concert with taking advantage of tax credits on their annual filings. Throughout in concert, the juice proverbially could be worth that squeeze. But it's an unfair expectation for every homeowner to do that work on their own, especially with how vague the code can be. And so what the state is proposing is that if this subsidiary corporation were created, one of the key tools that it would provide is a navigational aspect, working with homeowners, working with creditors, to be able to ensure that that stack could work. So, for example, a homeowner that might be incentivized to look at updating and making their home more energy efficient but might see a limited rebate could, upon further analysis, see, combined with an individual tax credit, there be enough of an incentive for them to work with a contractor and to engage in those energy efficient deployments. And this is a particular service that we feel we can do in concert with the private sector, Mr. Chairman. And those are my remarks on slide six. If I may, Mr. Chairman, go directly to slide eight. One of the questions that has been asked is, why does a housing finance authority or a public housing entity have a space when it comes to home energy efficiency? And it's no news to several members of this committee, I'm sure, but for the edification of the public, I'll very briefly move through these slides about what role the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has played in the space of energy improvements. When one looks at just the home improvement, Mr. Chairman, combined between the renovation loan option, our new construction rebate program that ran in parallel with our home energy rebate program from 2008 to 2016, and our existing weatherization program, where this legislature has for decades and through different administrations, regardless of partisan affiliation, made strategic investments to enhance the energy efficiency in urban and rural Alaska, have seen roughly one out of every five residential structures in the state of Alaska be touched with these dollars. The average improvement in terms of the energy usage is around 34%, and that's not an analysis that was conducted by the corporation, that was conducted by the Cold Climate Housing Research Center on the efficacy of both the home energy rebate program as well as the weatherization program. And I'm sure individuals such as Representative Tomaszewski could speak much more eloquently than me to this, given his role in the private sector as an energy rater. But we see that that has created a multi-decadal muscle memory, Mr. Co-Chair, where we understand the housing stock in this state and the intricate ways in which the community's energy demands are regionally very different from one another. And that allows us to be able to bring customized tools in different regions of the state that enable that success to occur regardless of the geographic disposition of any recipients. And that concludes my remarks on this slide, Mr. Chair.
Got a quick question, Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I appreciate this slide. This kind of brings it home to me. So what I'm hearing is that when you say new home rebate, this was the last time this was put into place. Is that correct? Through the chair. And then the other, so that's 3,636 homes affecting, improved 26,587. Does that mean homes? What does that number mean? Yes. Okay. And so is the idea that one could get a loan and that they presumably would be able to pay it off because the savings in their energy savings is so high that they would actually be seeing potentially a net positive once they were to receive the funding because of the energy savings. Is that how you spin it or sell it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galvin, if I may respectfully take a step back, the new home energy rebate or new home construction program, which existed from 2008 to 2016, operated in this manner. Mm-hmm. If an individual wanted to have a new home constructed and they ensured through an energy rating, once a certificate of occupancy was issued, that that home had an energy rating of 5-star plus or greater, then there was a sliding scale of a direct rebate that that home buyer could receive, anywhere from $7,000 to $10,000. And it was that program that the legislature funded that built those over 3,600 homes in the state of Alaska. Those homes specifically, and that was a policy call of the legislature to direct those to the home builder to receive that home buyer, pardon me, to receive the rebate as opposed to the home builder, in part because there wanted to be on the part of the legislature a direct benefit for a home buyer who was willing to both delay gratification in terms of having a new home be constructed, but also making a strategic investment that might on balance be a little more costly, but in the long run, realize those energy savings.
I think that I appreciate. I'm sorry. I was looking at this new home rebate, but then what I really wanted to hear about is the renovation loans, which I believe that must be the way one would be able to pay these loans off. If they're renovation loans, presumably they're going to see their energy costs drop significantly. Yes?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Galvin, the renovation loan option is also a product that we offer currently through our mortgage department. This is a particular loan that homeowners we're seeing increasingly take use of because their primary mortgages are under 4%, for example, and they have no intention of wanting to move from there for a variety of issues or reasons. But also, they would like to be able to take out a secondary loan to improve their housing stock and be able to realize those energy efficiency provisions.
Thank you. And through the chair, if I may, one last final one here. I see it's 434 renovation loans for more than $100 million. So that's a lot of money each loan. Is that right, or am I not doing the math properly?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Galvin, that does represent the aggregate amount of loans that the corporation has lent, working with partners, be they banks or credit unions, to these borrowers. And these are on residences that can be within the median household valuation. So if one were looking at taking out a second mortgage to enhance the footprint, for example, because they are 500 to 600 square feet undervalued for having a growing family and they want to make their home more energy efficient, that loan option is something that they have taken advantage of. One thing that we did in the last calendar year as well, Mr. Chair, is we changed the regulations for these loans because in the past, the amortization period for that second loan was too low. It was only for 15 years. And so even if it was something that might be potentially attractive for a homeowner to do to make their home more energy efficient, the monthly rate simply didn't pencil out. And so with the board's approval and based on feedback that was received from the Bankers Association and other entities, the corporation changed its regulations to extend that out to 30 years. And in so doing, making those monthly payments more cost effective to a homeowner.
Thank you. So through the chair, the idea then is you hope to grow more than 434. That seems a little bit like a low number, and your plan is to extend the loan to being longer than the 15 years, and perhaps you'll be able to garner the attention of more than the homeowner who could afford that. I assume that's what you're trying to get at. So then we'll potentially be seeing different numbers in the future. Yeah.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Galvin, that's correct, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On slide 9, when we talk about capacity building, the corporation also is engaged in the energy space in a couple of different ways. First, under state law, any loan that the corporation purchases is required to adhere to a building and energy code, which means we have to work with contractors and local governments on ensuring that any building that it would take paper to is in conformity with that particular provision, which means that there's a literacy muscle memory capacity that the corporation already has with the nearly 15,000 loans in its statewide portfolio. But from a proactive standpoint, the corporation also engages in trying to build literacy with local governments and public building owners through things such as the AK Warm energy modeling software, our home energy rating system. And we also have what is called the Building Monitoring System, or BMON. That is an open-source software that allows any building owner to take advantage of understanding what the lack of energy efficiency or any aberrations in their energy usage may result in. And we use this, for example, on all of our public housing infrastructure. And it allows us to detect if there is a significant aberration in short order. So, for example, recently out in Western Alaska, one of our public housing units near the boiler area showed a significant drop in temperature. That likely meant that there was a boiler failure. And we were able to deploy maintenance staff before we had a freeze up in the pipes, which would have been devastating, not to say life-threatening in some instances as well. And this is the kind of work that our research and rural development department engages in. But we also work with the state regional housing authorities on something called the Supplemental Development Program. Under the Native American Housing and Self-Determination Act, funds that come to entities such as our regional housing authorities can only be spent on the building envelope. And that's because of the federal restrictions trying to prevent tribal housing authorities in the lower 48 from building infrastructure in a place that significantly enjoys infrastructure. That's not the case in the state of Alaska. And so this supplemental housing program has for decades been the state, through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's way of partnering with regional housing authorities to deploy dollars to ensure that the building envelope is going to be tied to a water, a sewer, and an electric system, that those buildings can actually turn and have a certificate of occupancy. But we also provide training for our energy raters, and we do that through a variety of in-person and remote classes. Just in the last summer, collaborating with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, we took on a training in Fairbanks, and we intend to do more of that. We also have applied and have received funding through the Department of Energy for a framework and responsive code development program. What this is, Mr. Co-Chair, is a means in which there could be a template, if a local government so wished to develop a building code, that you could have a best practices set that have been identified. And that has just been awarded in January of this year. It's an award amount of approximately $1.1 million, and you will see more of that in the coming summer. But it points to, again, the relationship that the corporation has with the state home building associations, local entities, and aggregators such as the Municipal League, where we're trying to figure out that balance between the best practices of energy efficiency, but not being on paper so efficient that it comes to the cost detriment of Alaskans living in high-cost rural areas. And those are my remarks on this slide, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, on slide 10, very briefly, as this committee is no stranger to the discussion of the labor shortage, the corporation is trying to do its part, working collaboratively to build capacity with energy efficiency technicians. We understand that enabling a lot of young men and women to become literate on the subject of solar installation, weatherization, energy rating is going to be something that will be necessary. And we are engaged in that, culminating in this last February, where we had more than 100 people from across the state come to our EE Now training as well. We are going to see more of these events ramping up because we recognize that if we don't do that, we will get into a finite pool of labor that will then be subjecting all employers to a poaching mechanism, driving up the cost of being able to take fewer people, and by extension, every one of those additional dollars comes at the expense of houses that could be improved through that funding scheme for energy efficiency. Those are my remarks on this slide, Mr. Chair. But Mr. Chair, we've spoken about the financial instruments that the corporation brings to bear in bringing energy efficiency. We've spoken of the workforce readiness to help bring down the cost of energy usage in the state of Alaska. But we also are partnering with constructing and adding to the housing stock. And this is the 20th year that this legislature has seen the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation continuing what was originally called the Rural Teacher Program. It is now called the Rural Professional Program. And over 500 houses throughout 80 of the most remote and high-cost communities in the state of Alaska have been built using this program that are energy-efficient structures meant to house teachers, public health nurses, village public safety officers, city managers, custodians who we know don't in rural Alaska just mop the floors. There are technicians that keep the building lights on and keep the pipes from freezing. As part of that, Mr. Chair, we are also rolling out this year something that is called the Last Frontier Housing Initiative. This is a product of the legislature's funding in the 22 session of a significant investment to get housing built for state workers in remote areas. Three communities in Western Alaska were identified by the heads of Alaska's state departments for their most difficult places in which to locate housing for their workers. Those communities respectively were Nome, Kotzebue, and Bethel. And that is not for one second to say that there are not communities that do not have dire need, but from an order of magnitude, those were the top three. And so what the corporation did in the fall of last year, working with the Municipal League, was it approached those entities, cities and boroughs, on a government-to-government basis, and offered each of them $5 million, $3 million in state general funds, $2 million in soon-to-be-expiring emergency rental assistance funds from the United States Department of Treasury, to build two sets of housing. One set would be for state workers, and we're asking for a minimum of 6 units in each of those communities, and the other would be for affordable housing, because we know that in each of those communities, just as in every community in the state, there are more Alaskans that are at that 50% of area median income or below that do not have access to housing than there are houses available. And those dollars are being made on a government-to-government basis, and there's been significant progress working with all those communities. We've additionally put $9 million in Southeast Alaska as part of constructing affordable housing in Ketchikan and Sitka, respectively. We've asked those communities to come forward with a 15% match that could be done either through monetary means. Most are doing it through land or through bringing third-party financing, literally tacking on to another project so we can have economies of scale. We're trying to be as flexible as possible so that we're not competing with each other and driving up barge costs. And the collaboration with those local governments and developers has given us a lot of cause to be, I don't want to say overly optimistic, but we're cautiously optimistic that come next session, there will be a really good update on housing being built in some areas of our state that desperately need them. And ideally, we have a playbook that can increase that even more. And finally, on this slide, Mr. Co-Chair, to a previous question that Representative Galvin had as well, we also offer a rate reduction program that if an individual would like to be able to finance an energy-efficient home and they can prove the energy efficiency level, the corporation actually gives a reduction in the interest rate on that mortgage. And it's on a sliding scale depending on a number of factors, the creditworthiness of the borrower, the efficiency of that structure. But it's one more example of where we're trying to collaborate to increase the housing stock and also make it more appropriate for its energy usage. And those are my remarks on this slide, Mr. Chair. Very briefly on this, Mr. Chairman, we couldn't do what we do without the partners that are here. And so when this bill, House Bill 154 and its companion, Senate Bill 125, is before this body and the other body, we come to you not as just the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, but as an entity that collaborates with federal, state, local, nonprofit, and for-profit private sector entities that try to work in an intricate way in helping dissect the diciness that is trying to make building homes in Alaska affordable and achievable. And we couldn't talk at length of this, but I want to respect the committee's time, Mr. Chair. And if there are any questions that committee members have about any of these entities or local governments, we're happy to follow up on specifically what products, what projects we do with them. Mr. Chairman, in summary on this section, this corporation has a proud multi-decadal tradition of working collaboratively with entities both within the state government, local governments, and the private sector, both in the foreign nonprofit segments of our economy, to try to ensure that our mission of making affordable housing within reach of Alaskans that is safe and achievable can be met. We do it through many different federal and state funding tools. And as Mr. Thayer is going to mention presently, and we will afterwards talk about one case study, we recognize that there are some unique federal funding opportunities that will allow us to take the muscle memory that we've established in the past to present what we believe is a humble and balanced approach going into the future. And one way in which I would finally end on this, Mr. Chair, is that beginning in 1999, the corporation has a track record of standing up subsidiary corporations that are special purpose vehicles to meet the policy objectives of the legislature and the administration. Some of them are like the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation that eventually became independent of the Housing Finance Corporation. Some of them, such as the Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing, are still a subsidiary corporation of AHFC. And in a month, God willing, we will be cutting the ribbon on 44 new affordable housing units in the city of Fairbanks. We just did 18 senior housing units there. And we are looking now at the coastal and regional hubs as well. And we believe that it's that corporate governance maturity that the corporation's parent board has been able to give to those subsidiaries that allow for those specific tools to be effective. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer questions on this slide.
Representative Staff and then Hannon.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. The units in Fairbanks, is that the big complex that was just finished basically building off Iditarod and Hamilton Acres? I think so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Staff, I'd like to confirm that in writing with you. It's called the Meadows, and I used to have the street literally just listed on my previous slide as well, but I can get that to you at the end of this hearing, if that's appropriate, through the chair's office.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Hannon, and then Clone.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I'm just going to call you Mr. Ikey, but that's not it. It's Galapsos, Mr. Galapsos. In standing up the subsidiary, it does not appear that we are changing the board of directors in any way, shape, or form. And I guess in the back of my mind, I think we should, and I am wondering whether that was talked about as this legislation was developed, of why we don't stand up a separate board that might have a more specific focus on the green technology from the rest of the AHFC board.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannon, thank you for that question. And if I may be so bold, thank you for asking that as well last year, because it gave us a reason over the summer and fall to really examine the veracity of our response to you and your office. And we came to the same conclusion, which was we believe that the board is properly constituted as is for two key reasons. The first is the initial purpose of this legislation is to be able to stand up a subsidiary corporation that can ensure proper corporate governance procedures and successfully pursue federal funding. If it is successful in doing so, we anticipate that there will be a subsequent policy call from the next legislature, not dissimilar to what the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation underwent. And I'm not trying to imply a policy call one way or the other on that subsidiary, but merely pointing that as a case study, that the legislature wanted to see if a subsidiary in that case could be stood up. It was. They wanted to ensure that corporate and bond counsel could ensure that the internal workings and the audit functions would be proper, and it was. And then once the legislature made a determination for more targeted sets of funding, the determination at that point in the 2014 session was to divorce the subsidiary, essentially, from HFC, create a separate board altogether, because it had outgrown the need of being a subsidiary at that point. And we recognize that that is a call that can be made today or could be made in any future year. Our respectful submission to you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannon, is that this board under the current statutory framework is required to have one member with a financing background, and we do. We have a former banker from the Fairbanks area. We're required to have someone with a background in home building, and we do have that as well. We're required to have someone who also has a background in energy efficiency, and we have that as well. We're required to have an individual with an experience in rural house building, and we have that as well, a representative of one of the regional housing authorities. And we're also required to have someone who represents the senior community, a subset of our vulnerable populations who are serviced by our public housing authorities, but who could also benefit from some of the tools that the Green Bank can offer, and we have that as well. So we think that from a sequencing opportunity, having the parent corporation's board try to get the basics as consistent as possible, as positioned for success as possible from a federal funding acquisition standpoint, would enable the legislature to have as productive of a deliberation in subsequent years as possible. But we completely recognize that that is a policy call well within this body and its sister body's purview.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Colon.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Thank you for being here today. Just a couple of questions. One, you mentioned that the grants would be, I guess, funneled through regional aggregators. Can you tell me who that regional aggregator would be?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Colon, thank you for that question. And I'm just manipulating these slides to come back to slide number 5 for the benefit of the public, with your permission, Mr. Co-Chair. One of the regional aggregators is called the Coalition for Green Capital. It is an established national nonprofit organization, and the federal government has a track record of taking large tranches of these omnibus funding bills when there are discrete policy opportunities awarding them to the aggregators, who then work in concert with what they negotiated with the awarding entity. In this case, it's the United States Environmental Protection Agency, to then subgrant to entities such as hopefully the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation subsidiary, but other entities as well.
Follow up. So the Coalition for Green Capital that comes out of D.C.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Colomb, they do have an office in D.C. I believe that they're based in D.C. as well, yes. But we can get the committee more information on that.
Just wondering, follow up. If they were an Alaskan coalition. So I know that you mentioned the Municipal League, too. What role would they be having in this?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Colomb, the Municipal League has been a very helpful partner with the corporation in doing two things. One, understanding the capacity that local governments have in appreciating the implications in the United States tax code as it could benefit them. So one perfect example we can give you. The Municipal League, along with the Federation of Natives and the Governor's Office 2 weeks ago, hosted another infrastructure symposium with the Department of Treasury being one of the speakers. One of the items that the Department of Treasury wanted to bring up for the benefit of local governments was that non-taxed entities like local governments or school districts could have a provision in the tax code called elective pay, where if they had more energy efficient buildings, they could elect to file a tax and receive a direct grant or subsidy from the federal government. That is something that is very novel. It is something that most local governments would likely not have the experience in doing. And so by having the Municipal League work with entities such as the Housing Finance Corporation, understand what level of capacity some of these city management offices may have, how much legwork would they like our subsidiary corporation to do in concert, in respectful collaboration with them, is extremely helpful. But secondarily, being able to disseminate information on things that are very complex, like the interplay between a home energy rebate and an individual tax credit, that may make sense in Fairbanks, but may not pencil out, for example, in Tok, or may make sense with a different technology in Southeast Alaska, is what we'd be working on.
Okay, so follow-up. I guess what I'm getting at is, who's deciding where the grants are going? Is it the Coalition? Is it AHFC? Is it the Municipal League? Who's actually granting out the funds to different entities?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Colomb, the United States Environmental Protection Agency has made an initial award announcement to some aggregators, including the Coalition for Green Capital. These are what you would call national regional aggregators. They will then be working with the United States Environmental Protection Agency to ensure under what conditions they can subgrant to other individuals. I shouldn't say individuals, but other entities. These can be nonprofits. These can be local governments. These can be tribal entities as well. From there, the expectation and the hope from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's perspective would be that if it were to receive some of those funds, it would be able to put that into a subsidiary corporation if the legislature enacted this particular legislation. And depending on what the restrictions are on that funding, we would then be able to work on developing what type of programs from a financing perspective we could offer working with banks and credit unions for individual Alaskans and businesses.
And one last question.
Representative Klum.
So what happens to all this federal money if the Green Bank isn't there? Is this something that AHFC and AEA can absorb in some way and still receive funds?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Klum, the short answer is in some cases, yes. In some cases, it's unclear. But in both cases, what we have come to appreciate is that the complexity that is tied with each of these individual funding streams, combined with the tax credit implications for individual households, has the potential to tax, no pun intended, I'm sorry, the capacity of the Housing Finance Corporation's parent staff in the Mortgage Department, the Research and Rural Development Department, a subsidiary corporation with a specific focus on trying to harmonize that would be extremely helpful and would, in our position, be very effective.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. would you consider the aggregator then a middle person or middleman, so to speak? And can you give us any sense of, I assume they have a take then of the money. And just to follow up on Representative Colomb's thoughts, then I think what I heard you say is that because of the complexity, that surpasses your capacity to be able to handle this. Is there any choice of who the middle person entity is, or what that rate is that they will be paid or getting out of this take?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Galvin, with respect to the first question, if I understand it correctly, the Environmental Protection Agency will finalize their award negotiations with these aggregators, and that should conclude sometime, we're told, around the end of June. If that occurs, then the funding that's available through those entities is effectively binary. We have to negotiate with them because they have effectively been delegated through the Congressional Act, through the EPA, to do so. They are not the only funding opportunity. And one of the items that we'll talk about subsequently is a direct application that the Corporation and the Energy Authority has made for the Solar for All program. We also have another application through the Department of Energy for its Climate Pollution Reduction Grant program, which has, I wouldn't say fewer strictures, but they consider some of the existing programs that the corporation does, namely weatherization and the home energy rebate, where those would be direct awards. But I think, Mr. Chair, Representative, that elucidates just how complex this congressional legislation is. Because though that is a significant tranche of funds, we have additional tranches that will be announced sometime between this month, and literally the Solar for All announcement can come while we're sitting here, and for the benefit of this slide, I hope not, and sometime by the end of August. And so when we consider all of those playing with each other, being able to try to harness and track those funds on just this one segment on energy efficiency really is compelling us to try to distill that discipline.
Follow up, if I may. Okay, thank you. I appreciate that, and I appreciate your having a good sense of what the capacity is. And I guess from my perspective, not knowing all of the moving parts of this, my biggest concern is, are we giving whatever entity what's needed to make sure that we're hitting those deadlines, that we're, you know, putting our best foot forward and getting as much as we can, not only for energy projects, but also for housing projects, right? Both of those seem like really big, important pieces to me. And so my follow-up question, I guess, is more of a general ask about the plan. I've heard you say 500 units at one point. It's not in writing here. But then I've seen 58 units in Fairbanks. I've seen different amounts of homes getting different energy projects put in to lower their energy costs. And as you know, Alaska is all about what can we do to lower the costs and get more units in. You've mentioned units. Do you have an overall plan somewhere that maybe I can find as to how many units? You've mentioned five areas, I think, but I'm curious to know if we can get our hands wrapped around what is the goal?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Galvin, it's an extremely fair question, and the fairest answer I can give you is until we have eyes on what the awarded federal amounts are, we couldn't begin to quantify what it looks like. The previous slides that we shared with this committee simply shows what we have been able to do with our existing programs historically and with existing resources now within the departments of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The funding award opportunities are going to dramatically enhance or constrict the aperture of our programmatic development. And I would be remiss if I were to say that we could give you that specificity at this point. In terms of the plan, the legislation contemplates the Housing Finance Corporation being able to create a subsidiary that is, as from a corporate governance perspective, as resilient but as basic as possible and as versatile enough to respond to these federal funding opportunities in a timely manner, because that September 30th deadline is looming for us. And what we would hope to achieve is being able to have the corporation come before this committee next year, should this legislation pass, have some successful announcements with respect to what federal awards have been made, and engaging in the type of stakeholder interactivity to understand what type of programs, working with banks, credit unions, local governments, tribal entities, given that funding stack, may work as well. And it would be our determination to have that specificity.
Representative Co-Chair Johnson and then Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I hear what you have to say, and the opportunities are out there. That you need to have the subsidiary in place, which is the legislation that we have before us. Is there anything, you know, it seems fairly straightforward, although there's not an exact number on some of these dollar amounts, but is there something that I should be looking for that I'm missing? I mean, we could talk about this for a long time, but I'm just trying to figure out what I might, is there something you would like to call attention to, or should I be paying attention to that to know more about this? Because what I'm hearing, maybe we just need to, it looks fairly straightforward to me.
Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Johnson, at the risk of being curt, we more or less agree.
Okay.
But with your permission, Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Johnson, at the conclusion of this slide deck, there are one or two observations that working in parallel with the companion piece in their body, we've identified from a drafting perspective that we think could make this a more effective piece of legislation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks. We'll go to Representative Josephson, and then maybe if we could finish out, I think there's only four more slides, and we'll get through those. Then we come back to questions. After that, we've got the fiscal notes we're going to work through. We also have invited testimony, so just so folks know. With that, Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair, Mr. Galopsis, you and I talked about the other body's version of the bill. At one point, there was, I think as originally suggested, a $20 million fiscal note. Can you tell us what the purpose of that was for originally and why it's okay if that's not in this bill?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Josephson, with the co-chair's leave, I'll briefly lay out what that conversation was as it pertains to the end of the presentation. But fundamentally, with respect to the text of the bill before this committee on House Bill 154, Section 4 of the bill, which would establish an Energy Independence Fund, had language in it that, from a sequencing perspective, would have had the parent corporation designated as the fiduciary of the fund, but also permitted to waive the prudent investor rule. And upon feedback that the corporation received from bond counsel, it was very apparent that, as well-meaning as that drafting was, there was a risk of the parent's corporate veil being pierced. And in so doing, I don't mean to sound alarmist, there's the potential for it to have jeopardized the securitization of the mortgages that this corporation issues. The reason for the fiscal note was that if there was going to be a fund established before a subsidiary had been stood up, and this goes, Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Johnson, to the question of being more effective with legislation, this is one of them. Having that fund capitalized with general fund would have been able to give security, or I should say some relief, to the rating agencies who wanted to ensure that there would not be an unfunded attempt to appropriate from the corporation's core responsibilities for the purposes of energy efficiency. Being able to simply ask for federal authority but not having received that and having an unfunded, from a general fund perspective, fund could have left the parent corporation exposed. Upon collaboration with the rating agencies, bond counsel, the governor's office, and the other body's finance committee, we recognized that if the objective from a primary purpose is to stand up a subsidiary corporation, receive the federal funding, and recognize that there will be policy implications after that funding is in hand to see whatever funds would be crafted as a result of that and whatever composition that subsidiary would want to look at, then the most effective thing would be to remove the language in Section 4 initially. And that's what the other body did. And once they did that, in talking with bond counsel, we were able to reduce the fiscal note from $20 million of general fund capitalization to zero, with the expectation that we are still going to pursue $20 million in federal awards in this year that we feel we have a reasonable chance of being able to do so. And I believe that answered the question, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Josephson, but if it did not, I apologize.
One follow-up.
Follow-up.
Through the chair. Yeah, we shouldn't think that there shouldn't at some future date be some state cooperation in the investments, though. Is that right? That there's going to be match requirements, or we'll have to participate as well with our own general fund dollars?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Josephson, that is a distinct possibility, and that does set the stage for, depending on what the capital stack looks like awarded from the federal entities, a set of policy considerations that would come to both the administration and to the legislature for its decision on how that would wish to be alliterated.
Okay, please proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and our apologies for running a little belatedly. With your permission, on slide 14, I will now turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Thayer, who's available telephonically to talk through the next slides, and I will move at a faster clip when I resume.
Thank you. Mr. Thayer, if you can put yourself on the record.
All right. Hello. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. My apologies for not being in Juneau on this trip. I was down last week, but had pressing business today in Anchorage. A little bit about AEA and the uniqueness of this relationship. In the bill itself, it has the corporation, Alaska Housing. They contract with the Alaska Energy Authority to provide technical review, energy infrastructure, expertise, and analysis for the proposed sustainability energy development loans. And with AEA, we own the state's largest hydro facility, as well as 210 miles of transmission lines. But we're unique in rural Alaska by operating the power cost equalization program for residential homes and for community buildings. So we have a firsthand knowledge of rural Alaska, and then coupled with our work with rural energy, with the construction of bulk fuel tank farms, diesel powerhouses, and renewables in rural Alaska. And we do have a team here at AEA that provides technical assistance and analysis of alternative energy technologies to benefit Alaskans, which includes biomass, hydro, solar, wind, and others. And we're also very familiar with grants and loans. We've been very successful, thanks to the legislature, with the Renewable Energy Fund, and have put over $300 million out on the street, and have displaced 85 million gallons of diesel fuel. And that particular program is looking for capital such as this, because we can help do the feasibility, reconnaissance, and early work, but taking it to the next step. There's now over 100 projects in rural Alaska operating because of the Renewable Energy Fund, and it has, like I said, it's been a huge success. And then in addition to that, AEA does have limited funds that we have the Power Project Fund, where we've funded 16 projects across Alaska, primarily in renewable. And again, something this fund would also be able to help augment that, and as we identify projects. The next slide is just kind of a footprint map of where AEA is active, whether it be powerhouses or bulk fuel or emerging technologies, renewables, transmission lines. But clearly, we on top, and then when you look at the Alaska Housing and the footprint they put on top of this, we do together cover every region of the state and every community in the state. And next slide. And again, I think this particular slide highlights the pulling together with AEA and Alaska Housing doing a joint application for $100 million for Solar for All. And as Ike had said, we are anticipating any day to receive word whether we have that. And this is on top. This funding is on top of $74 million in energy rebates and energy efficiencies that is coming through AEA that we're working with and will be administered by Alaska Housing. And so when you look at this project, we're already working together on literally hundreds of millions of dollars worth of projects. And this just seems to be a natural relationship for us. And we're very glad to support this legislation and support Alaska Housing in it taking the lead on it. And I would be available for any questions.
Okay, maybe if we could go ahead and jump into slide 17, and then we'll bring it back to questions and then jump into the fiscal notes.
For the record, Mr. Chair, Ike Gilopsis of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Slide 17's content, I think, has been alluded to, and so very briefly, should House Bill 154, its companion piece of legislation, pass this body and the other body and be signed into law by the governor, what the corporation anticipates for the remainder of 2024 is that the corporation's parent board would then instigate, working with legal counsel, a nonprofit subsidiary governance procedure that's trying to run in tandem while these awards are occurring at the federal level. So to Representative Hannon's question of the timeliness of the interaction of the board, from our perspective, that is a very ripe question, but one that would be very difficult to try to constitute a new board with a new corporation while simultaneously pursuing funding. For our respectful position, a sequencing might be another appropriate route that we have proposed going forward. And we would also be engaged in trying to procure, and the fiscal note, Mr. Co-Chair speaks to this, two staff, one primary staff that would have some background in financing, but also working in energy projects to understand what the yield rates would be working with potential customers and partners, but also some administrative staff. Because going back, Mr. Co-Chair, to that discussion that Representative Josephson raised about the corporate veil, the corporation has to be very considerate about trying to say that it has a non-recourse subsidiary while trying to fund the operations of a subsidiary with its own proceeds. That would potentially incite a legal challenge in a hypothetical scenario on any of our other indentures. And should any awards occur, which we are very optimistic, as Mr. Thayer has noted, our intent is to come before the legislature in 2025 with that update and with anticipating there being fresh policy considerations for what this subsidiary corporation and its newfound tools and funding streams would do. And with that, Mr. Co-Chair, that is the end of our prepared remarks. We sincerely thank you and the committee for indulging us with your patience, and we're prepared to answer any additional questions or go over the fiscal note in more detail.
Great, thank you very much. So before we go into fiscal notes, just any more questions on the slides? Okay, seeing none, we'll jump right into the fiscal notes. So we've got fiscal notes from HFC, AEA, and DOA. So with that, we'll start with you, Mr. Glopsos, if you could walk us through HFC's fiscal note.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. The corporation has associated with the language in this bill two components for the fiscal note. One, as I mentioned, is projected to be $450,000 in unrestricted general fund costs for the staffing of two positions, some travel, because we anticipate that that staff will necessarily need to begin relationship building in remote parts of Alaska to make sure that there's equity in the servicing of those tools, and also ensuring proper commodities and equipment as well. The capitalization, as the bill is currently written, is for $40 million, $20 million, it would be for UGF, and $20 million would be for federal receipts.
And just so we've got it on the record, which OMB component number fiscal note are you referring to?
I have, Mr. Co-Chair, OMB component number 110.
110. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any questions on the fiscal notes for, looks like it's HFC, Agency Department of Revenue? I don't see any questions. If folks think of any, we can come back to that. So next up, we have Mr. Thayer, who will walk us through the fiscal notes for AEA and ADA. Mr. Thayer?
Thank you. And for the record, Curtis Thayer, Executive Director of Alaska Energy Authority. You actually have two fiscal notes that I will speak to. The first one is the Alaska Energy Authority's fiscal note, which has services of $152,000 per year, and that is for a new employee to work in the planning department in administering and working with this program and providing the technical review. It's $127,000 annually for an assistant project manager with an ongoing support services analyst position to support that at $25,000. So it's one position, and that would cover the travel, third-party economic evaluations, obviously the work within the planning department and course services. The reason that you see a second fiscal note is through ADA is because AEA has no employees. This goes back 30-plus years. And so the actual position is housed in ADA, and we contract for our employees. We pay for our employees. We basically lease our employees. And so ADA is acknowledging one position for $127,000.5, which matches up with our fiscal note. And then our fiscal note, like I said, then we lease that one employee for the same thing. So you have two fiscal notes, but you have one employee with one, just being the uniqueness of AEA not having employees and having to contract for our employees through ADA.
Great. Thank you. And just so I've got that on the record, AEA's fiscal note is OMB component number 2600. And then the ADA's fiscal note is OMB component 1234. Do we have any questions on those fiscal notes? Okay, seeing none. We now have Mr. Eric DeMoulin, the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Administration, and he'll walk us through the fiscal note for DOA. Mr. DeMoulin, if you can put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, Eric DeMoulin, Admin Services Director for the Department of Administration. OMB component number 59, section 4 of this legislation calls for the creation of the Alaska Energy Independence Fund. The Division of Finance would have to set up this fund in the system of record IRIS and then be able to report on the activities of this fund in the annual comprehensive financial report. We consider that to be just routine business for the division, and the department submits a zero fiscal note.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing no questions, thank you very much. I would now like to go over to public testimony. We have a few people who would like to speak to this. And so I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony on HB 154. And anyone who's watching online can submit written public testimony by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. We've got a couple people in the room as well as a few online here. So I'm going to start with, looks like Summers Cole, if you're in the room, if you'd like to put yourself on the record, if you can state your name and your affiliation, and thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Edgman, and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Summers Cole. I was born and raised on Klinkadani here in Juneau, Alaska. Today, I'm testifying in my role as Alaska Government Affairs Manager with Nature Conservancy. I'd first like to thank Governor Dunleavy for introducing the HB 154 last session, and to thank this committee for hearing it again today. We've submitted a letter to the committee in support of establishing this subsidiary corporation at the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Additionally, we have submitted for the record a recently published nonpartisan report from McKinley Research Group entitled Energy Financing in Alaska, which provides some context for this opportunity. This legislation has been proposed during convergence of several dynamic circumstances and has the potential to be a timely contributor to common sense solutions. Affordable financing opportunities for the deployment of energy efficiency improvements and clean energy sources can help diversify Alaska's energy portfolio, decrease emissions, and serve as a vector for economic stimulus in Alaska. Recently, the federal government has made available, as you've heard, several large buckets of funding for the expansion of renewable energy at the state level, most notably via the Inflation Reduction Act, which is postured to invest $27 billion into sustainable energy funds via competitive grants. With the right type of institution in place, as HB 154 lays out, Alaska can leverage federal and private dollars to increase our energy independence across the state. We support this bill without reservation, and encourage the committee to pass this bill out and move it to the House for consideration by the entire body. Thank you very much for your time. We'll keep it brief here, and thank you for your work on this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. Do we have any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you. Also in the room, we've got Sarah Navigne, I believe. If you could put yourself on the record and state your name, your affiliation. Thanks for being here today.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Edgemond, Foster, and Johnson, and members of the House Finance Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 154. For the record, my name is Sarah Navile, and I live in Anchorage. I am an Alaska Fellow and serve as the Energy Transition Fellow at Alaska Venture Fund. I'm testifying on behalf of Alaska Venture Fund, an Alaska nonprofit with a mission to create a more vibrant and sustainable future for Alaska. We believe HB 154 is an excellent step for Alaska's energy future and will help foster needed innovation in the energy arena. An Alaska Energy Independence Fund would optimize the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's ability to fund energy programs and projects for all of Alaska. By functioning as a green bank, the fund would help capture federal dollars and leverage private investment. Green banks have proven to be effective mechanisms for catalyzing investment in clean energy projects across the country. From 2011 to 2022, green banks leveraged $10.6 billion in private capital, using $4.2 billion in public dollars. Operating in 28 states plus Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, green banks have demonstrated their capacity to drive job creation, economic growth, and environmental sustainability. We urge the House Finance Committee to support HB 154 and set a course for a more resilient and sustainable energy future for Alaska. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Great, thank you. Do we have any questions from the committee? I don't see any, so thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, I think we actually just have one person online. I believe it's Diane Chapman. If you're online, I believe you're here for testimony. If you are, if you could state your name, your affiliation. One more time, Ms. Chapman, are you online? Okay, I don't hear Ms. Chapman. So with that, is there anyone else online who would like to testify? Seeing none, we will go ahead and close public testimony on HB 154. And again, if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by writing us, emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. Are there any questions of the committee before we move to the next bill? Looks like we've got Representative Hannon and Representative Kocher Edgman.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I want to return to fiscal notes for a minute. In fiscal note OMB component 110, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, its narrative speaks to two PCNs and calls them a program manager and a program assistant. Mr. Thayer spoke to component 2600 at AEA and described that that PCN of an assistant project manager, different than a program manager, and I understand its sort of duplication with OMB component 1234. So I'm just, in reading these fiscal notes, it appears to me that there will be three PCNs created, two at AHFC and one at AEA. And I want to understand that accurately.
Mr. Galapsos, if you or Mr. Thayer would like to take that question.
For the record, again, Mr. Co-Chair, Ike Gilopsis of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hannon, that's correct. From the corporation's perspective, the subsidiary would have two staff. Section 3 of House Bill 154, as its companion legislation, Senate Bill 125, charges the Energy Authority and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to coordinate in a more explicit technical assistance provision manner. And it's the demand upon both the Energy Authority and the corporation that led to the promulgation of that fiscal note. And respectfully, Mr. Kocher, I'll defer to Mr. Thayer to explain the necessity of that third position, if necessary.
Mr. Thayer?
Thank you. For the record, Curtis Thayer with the Alaska Energy Authority. Yes, what we did is we are having an additional body. Our planning department currently is three people, and with what we anticipate the size and possible funding level, that would be required. It would require another full-time position on the AEA side due to the fact that we would need to be doing technical reviews, energy infrastructure expertise, and the analysis of sustainable energy and development loans. I do not believe it will be all needed at one time, but most definitely as this program is developed and the potential for it, the one new position, and it is an assistant project manager, different title, different job requirement between the two, but we would have this being an assistant project manager reporting to a existing project manager here on staff.
Okay.
And then
Representative Hannon?
Mr. Galapsos, Mr. Chair, sort of alluded to a Section 4 of the bill potentially needing an amendment or a change, and I'm wondering if we're did I misunderstand that? Are we going to see a committee substitute, or is there a proposed amendment to modify that Section 4, or is it?
I'll be setting an amendment deadline, and we can work through that. But Mr. Galapsos, you have such great presence that assumed you were a representative. Mr. Galapsos?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hannon, thank you for that question. With respect to that, Section 4 of the bill is something that the other body had extricated from its draft and did so to Representative Josephson's question, ameliorate the concern that the Corporation and Bond Council had. Now, that being said, the Corporation would be extremely supportive and grateful to this committee's consideration if one of the items which was inadvertently extricated from Section 4, that related to prioritizing the state energy policy and also prioritizing residential energy efficiency, be contemplated as being retained as a mission of the subsidiary corporation. Because what we have heard, Mr. Co-Chair, is a scope question. Who would the subsidiary corporation primarily try to serve? And while it would never, unless the legislature determines otherwise, attempt to exclude anyone explicitly, it's very clear that energy efficiency for residential components is within the bailiwick of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. It's where most of these funding streams would be done, and the corporation would be appreciative of that type of guidance.
Representative Hannon?
I'm good, thanks.
Okay, thanks. Representative Edgman?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just want to go on the record as saying this is a sleeper bill, in my view. This bill is more significant than maybe we know, given the opportunities that are out there, not only to sort of take the portfolio of things that HFC does and use that vast network to impact everyone in Alaska, but also just to leverage private sector capital. And I guess my first question would be, are we in any way that you can identify, comparing this to its previous iteration, which was 2021 and 2022, the bill that didn't quite make it as far, are we in any way limiting our ability to attract those hundreds of millions of private sector dollars that are out there waiting for something like this to be put in a law? Are we sort of underselling that at all in any way that you can see?
Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Edgman, the short answer is no. This legislation was drafted with the greatest respect to recently passed congressional legislation, something that was, just owing to circumstance, not available to the previous piece of legislation that was alluded to in the 2021 and 2022 legislative sessions. And so our respectful proposition is enabling a subsidiary to pursue sustainable energy development maximizes the tools that the corporation and the state, by extension, would have available to collaborate with the Energy Authority to take advantage of those federal funding opportunities.
So if I could continue, a couple more quick questions. So if this bill passes, you've got to set up a subsidiary corporation, you've got to hire staff, you've got to put a team together. Is that somewhere out there on the horizon? Do you have individuals identified? Is that sort of already underway, even before the bill getting signed into law by the governor? I say that because I'm going to do everything in my power to push to get this thing passed this year. This is year four. We've had this before us. A lot of opportunities have gone by the wayside in those past several years. We need to have this part of the energy portfolio that emerges from this legislature. If I could a little overbearing on that point. But where are you in terms of getting this thing up and going internally?
Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Edgman, with respect to steps that the corporation can legally and explicitly take, the board of directors needs to wait for legislative sanction to be able to take formal action. But its bond and corporate counsel has been reviewing these proceedings. It has been apprised of the type of questions and as well as the feedback that we have seen in other green banks that have been constituted in other jurisdictions in the United States. So there is a parallel track that is undergoing itself. With respect to the question of staff, with the greatest respect, Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Edgeman, there are a couple individuals, and to try to preserve our competitive advantage in approaching them, I'd rather not say who they are.
I guess my last point, Mr. Co-Chair, would be that there will be a fairly significant energy sustainability conference set. I think it's happening May 21 to May 24 in Anchorage. It's become quite a marquee event that maybe ties a little bit into CERA Week in Houston and other things in terms of being able to attract top flight sort of representation from around the country. It would be my hope that we can get this bill through, signed, and perhaps even signed at the conference, like we signed a renewable energy grant fund a bill last year, and really target getting this thing through because it's nigh past time, and it's just good policy that's waiting to happen to benefit the entire state. So thank you.
Great, thank you. Representative Josephson?
Sure, it might be helpful if Mr. Ganopoulos sent a very short email, it's my favorite kind, summarizing the improvements to Section 4 that he had in mind. Sometimes hearing things or reading them again is helpful.
It's a good suggestion, Mr. Glopsos. Okay, well, if there are no further questions, appreciate the presentation. We have 39 minutes left in finance. If we could just take 1 minute to stretch our legs, grab some coffee, and then we'll start the next bill presentation. So with that, we'll take a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:54 p.m. And I forgot to mention the amendment deadline for the last bill that we just heard, which is 1:54, the Green Bank bill. And if folks could submit amendments to my staff, which is Brody Anderson, or the finance clerk, Ms. Helen Phillips, by next Monday, April 22nd at 5 p.m. For amendments. Sure appreciate that. So again, that's next Monday, April 22nd at 5 p.m. So going to the next bill before us here, we have House Bill 223. That's tax and royalty for certain gas from the Department of Natural Resources. We heard this bill about 10 days ago, so this will be a follow-up. It looks like the presentation is fairly short, about 7 pages. And so with that, I'll ask Mr. Derek Nottingham, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, as well as Deputy Commissioner John Crowther, to please come to the table, put yourselves on the record. And also online, we have Mr. Johnny Meza, Commercial Section Chief of the Division of Oil and Gas, available for questions. So with that, looks like we have Mr. Nottingham here. I thought I saw Mr. Crowther earlier, but you can put yourself on the record.
Yeah, for the record, I'm Derek Nottingham, the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And my colleague, John Crowther, will be in here shortly. I do have my commercial section manager, Johnny Mason, on the line to answer any questions as we move through the slides. So with that, we'll just go ahead and get started.
Great.
So the goals of HB 223, just to reiterate from our previous meetings, is that the rail belt utilities are facing a shortage in the near future. And one of the quickest ways that we see is DNR to fill that gap is to produce more gas from Cook Inlet. That is the only solution that we see in the immediate term, meaning, say, the next 5 years or so. So the goal is to increase available gas supply from the Cook Inlet by encouraging investments in projects that we know have been discovered. Those gas accumulations have been pretty much appraised, but the producers that would be developing them are seeing financial hurdles. And what this bill does is basically improve some of those decision criteria that they're facing, such as rate of return and payback time. So the mechanics of this bill is it reduces royalty for 10 years on three categories of qualified new oil and gas. It touches on fields or pools that have not been developed. So that would benefit accumulations that have been discovered but have not been brought into production to date. It also promotes exploration for undiscovered resources. It also touches on fields or pools that had produced in the past but were offline during 2024. So those are fields that are currently shut in, and if they were to be brought back online, they would receive this royalty benefit. And it also touches on wells that would be drilled in the fields or pools that are currently online, but can't the resources that they would capture cannot be produced from the existing well set. So it incentivizes drilling outside of what we call the current drainage area of wells producing today. So those resources targeted, we've hit on this a little bit already, but just to kind of reiterate, it is targeting discovered but undeveloped oil and gas resources. And we've mentioned there's some barriers to financial investment in these projects, high upfront capital costs, federal permitting challenges, gas market uncertainty, oil service industry challenge. Those all kind of make up the context of the Cook Inlet and why investors may shy away from doing these projects and moving to, you know, projects, say, in the lower 48. The major accumulations that we see in the Cook Inlet that are having some of these obstacles, Bluecrest Cosmopolitan Project, they publicly stated around 250 BCF of recoverable resource in their gas prospect. Hex Fury's Kitchen Lights development, they've publicly stated around 300 BCF of recoverable resource in their development. So combined, that's 550 BCF, considering that the Cook Inlet demand per year is about 70 BCF per year. That gives you, if you just do the quick math, that's about 8 years of additional life by bringing those two fields online. And as I mentioned, these projects are competing for equity capital with lower 48 investments, which have much lower upfront costs, they have shorter payback, and they have a more certain environment. So reducing the royalties on these projects, it helps them, you know, to claw back at some of those disadvantages that the projects see. So what I'll describe to you on this slide is what we see is the status quo versus what we see in terms of the royalty reduction under HB 223 in regards to state revenues. Now, these are DNR's estimates. They're not the official estimates that would come from, like, DOR. We feel like they're a representative ballpark estimate of what the current regime would yield and what HB 223 regime would yield if it's successful and also if it's not successful. So just to kind of talk about the status quo, the current regime, this is what we forecast our gas production will be if the new developments do not come online. And under that scenario, under the current royalty rates, the expected revenues to the state from the period 2025 to 2035 are estimated to be $648 million. If HB 223 is successful and it leads to the new investments that we're projecting, then that future gas will likely meet the Rail Belt consumer demand for at least the next 10 years and will ultimately lead to revenues we estimate of $659 million. So a difference in those two numbers of about $11 million. So a slight improvement, actually, in the state revenue is what we'd estimate. If the royalty reduction is not successful, meaning those projects that we hope to come online and anticipate coming online don't bring in new gas production, then the state could lose $40 million over that period with very small amounts in the earlier time frame, and that $40 million loss would be because there would be some drilling that would be done over the next 10 years or so that would occur whether the royalty provision was made or not. The next slide, it shows graphically what's happening based on the summary that I just provided in the previous slide. So the shaded area in blue, that's our revenue over time under the status quo. The darker dashed line would be revenue under HB 223, but in a failure case. And then the gray dashed line would be revenue under HB 223, if those projects that we anticipate coming online are successful. And these revenue impacts are royalty, production taxes, and property taxes. And in my final slide, what this shows is the estimated impacts on the gas supply costs in a hypothetical situation. So I'll just kind of run through the assumptions in the hypothetical project and then talk about the supply cost impact. So this scenario that we're demonstrating here is an investment of $350 million into a 250 BCF project, not unlike some of the projects that we see out there awaiting investment in the Cook Inlet. And what the cost of supply here that we're estimating is the minimum price that investors would require to fund this investment. Not necessarily whether it's economic, but what's the minimum price required to meet certain criteria by those investors in order to invest in the project. And those criteria are, in this analysis, a payback time of 4 years and a minimal annual real return rate of 15%. And so using those criteria, under the current royalty regime, that cost of supply would be $12.26 per MCF. Under HB 223, that cost of supply would be $10.48. So that's a reduction of $1.74. That is a hypothetical scenario, but in general, that would be translated right back to the consumers of energy in the Rail Belt. And that is my final slide.
Great. Thank you very much. Do we have questions of the committee? Looks like we've got Representative Josephson, then Representative Staff.
Yes. Thank you, through the chair. Good morning, Mr. Good afternoon. Maybe morning in the Far East. I was thinking of that. Mr. Nottingham, there's a case, and I knew it was there, and I found it. It's called Trustees versus State of Alaska. It's a 1987 decision, and it says a number of things, but one of the things it says is that, at least in that case, we weren't allowed to take a 0% royalty. Do we know that legally we're allowed to take a 0% royalty?
Mr. Crowther, if you can put yourself on the record.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. So I don't want to assert that we were able to speak formally for the Attorney General's office or for the Legislative Legal Office, as they naturally may render opinions on the same question. We do believe that for purposes of analyzing the constitutional and general statutory frameworks for the state to receive benefit from the development of our resources, that this legislation would not have a royalty for these specific categories, but would have the benefits of production and would have other incidental revenue benefits. As we discussed in the prior slide, if resources are brought online, there'd be incrementally more revenues. So we believe that from a policy perspective is consistent with our intent and need to see benefit from the resources. But I don't want to assert that that's an Attorney General's opinion or consistent with how Legislative Legal may answer that question as to is zero an acceptable royalty amount.
Follow up.
Did the state or has the state considered a deferred royalty where there would be no royalty for a time and then a payment of the royalty in the out years?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, John Crowther again here. We don't view the bill as a deferred royalty in the sense that royalties would accrue from production now and then be paid in the future. However, the bill does have a 10-year window for applicability. So at the end of that 10 years, the royalty from developed projects would begin to accrue at the 12.5%. And you can see on slide 6 here, in this hypothetical depiction, the gray line does show those new resources coming online, and you see in the 2038 timeframe when that 10-year expiry would occur that the revenue to the state measurably ticks back up. And so we don't think of this as a deferred royalty bills generally, but it does feature that sunset time limitation provision.
Paul Wood?
Yes. New question, if I might. I consulted with someone recently about this, and one question I wanted to ask is, did the administration consider an option where the state is the purchaser and I don't know if the right word is broker, but essentially the state is the purchaser of new gas such that we could meet our own customers' needs, municipalities, school districts, et cetera, the state government, and then instill the confidence in firm contracts so that there might be enhanced new production.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I think from the broader administration perspective and on the issue of kind of energy supply and markets, there has been some discussion and consideration of those topics. We'd be happy, and we think it's a very natural topic for the legislature to inquire about how to support a market for coke inlet gas and in-state resources generally that has the most abundance and the most economic development of those resources. For purposes of HB 223, we believe a highly competitive royalty that brings those projects onto market, obviously the utilities and the consumers are the end buyers, but we think that royalty regime needs to be adjusted to enable those projects to move forward, and that those kind of questions of how the state could, if consistent with policy objectives of the legislature and the administration, be a participant in the market are better considered in other potential legislation and that this is a bill that we need to act on immediately.
Representative Josephson?
Well, yes. What, just to be clear, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 5, the foregone revenue is the $40 million per year, or help me sort of crystallize that.
Mr. Crowther?
Yeah, Representative Josephson, through the chair. That $40 million number is an aggregate based on the assumptions and approximations, and for this is just a scenario exercise, is the aggregate number of less royalty to the state for that 10-year period. So we have a supplemental slide in the appendix that I believe is right here that shows the per year delta. It's a little bit of a complex chart, but it shows the per year delta or per year revenue in the event that the legislation is enacted and no new resources are developed. Now, the intent of the legislation is to bring those new resources to market, so to receive incrementally very little in terms of royalty, but still some additional revenue from those new resources. But in the event that no new resources come online and the bill is passed and development proceeds consistent with these assumptions, there'd be $40 million less revenue over the full 10-year period. Thank you.
Okay, I've got Representative Stepp and then Galvin. Representative Stepp.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster, through the chair, to our wonderful DNR folks. First question is, if you assume a minimum or really a payback time of 4 years for an investor, why would you extend the royalty for an entire decade? Why not just extend the royalty for the time it takes the producer to recoup its cost of investment? Mr. 4 years.
Mr. Crowther?
Representative Stapp, through the chair, I think we would these developers are looking at holistic evaluations across several criteria when they're sanctioning projects. And one of the things we've heard from the market is the payback times in Alaska can be much longer than very short payback times for other investment destinations. And so that's why they have that four-year payback time as a kind of critical component of their evaluation. They're also naturally looking at the return over a full project life cycle, which may be 20 years. And so while that's not highlighted on our chart, we believe that 10-year balance, and this is a policy question that naturally the legislature may want to evaluate, but we believe that 10-year balance is very material and cognizable to the near-term returns, but doesn't permanently release the state from royalty for a project that may produce for 20, 25, or even longer, 20 or 25 years.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up?
Yeah, through the chair. Yeah, the reason I asked the question again is because on the slide deck it says you're making the assumption of the investment, right? Payback time of 4 years and the annual realized return of 15%. So if the barrier is the startup capital economics, it would make sense to me that you would be basically foregoing that in order for the company to make that risk. But the longer you draw out that no royalty, the more risk that state is going to share of that production of well. Does that make sense? So like what I'm saying is, let's say, they drill well and the supply is like far greater than they thought it was going to be. So they're producing a ton more from that particular well. And now they have a zero royalty for a decade when they could recoup their costs in theory quicker. Is there any way, I guess, that DNR could adjust that midterm, or when you're locked into the 10-year royalty, you're locked into it?
Mr. Crowther?
Representative Stapp, through the chair, the legislation does provide the relief for that 10-year period, and we think that line of inquiry, there is interchange between the payback period, the royalty rate, the reduction. Just one point I'd make for yourself and the committee, when we look at this chart on the left, and this does go to some of the dynamics I believe we've discussed previously in the committee, and this is in the appendix slide 10, this chart shows these new resources potentially coming online and that production profile in gray on the left side of the chart. What you'll notice there is that in the kind of near term but out years, 2029, 2030, that production is significantly above the 70 BCF of demand. And so implied to, quote, make this market work, whether it's a state buyer, as Representative Josephson mentioned, whether it's some other private sector buyer, you're going to have some level, whether it's storage, have some level of kind of demand and supply smoothing throughout that period. And that's why even if a project is very successful with startup within the goal time frame, they may not be able to sell a full volume immediately and fully return. And so that buffer in the bill, so to speak, is because we want to make the projects as competitive as we can in the reality that there's multiple challenges in the market right now for cogeneration.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, on that line through the chair, you talked about making the market work. So I still haven't really heard anyone articulate to me a good reason of why you wouldn't just let the price float at the end user, right? So if the issue is the return on investment at the point of production, i.e. the CapEx for the company, that to me is solved by just allowing the price at the end user to float upwards, because there would be more profit margin for the company to make that investment. So if we're arguing over $2 and actually not even $2, $1.88 or something, right, then you would think that the point of sale, if that price went up by more than that, that would offset the economics. I hope you could explain that to me.
Mr. Crother?
Yeah, Representative Stapp, through the chair, you know, I would say that we view there's two policy rationales, and you know the administration and we view this bill as a policy rationale that the developments that are not occurring today should be as competitive as they can to move forward. The royalty in the legislation goes to zero, so that reduces the take to the state in royalty terms from those new projects. There's still other ancillary revenue metrics. The concept of the market fully floating, the market is floating today and we have not seen the project sanctioned. Now, there may be reasons why, whether it's consumer acceptance of those dynamics, whether it's regulatory restrictions on supply contracts, whether it's other terms out there, the market is, on some level, we can presume it's equivalating to this new supply and demand picture. But from the administration's perspective, we don't want to wait and hope that that happens. We want to bring forward legislation and encourage and push it forward as aggressively as we can to try and get the supply security for the consumer. And then I would secondarily note that the it's a very, you know, this legislation, because of the importance of the Cook Inlet to consumers in Alaska, is more general than historical provisions and enactments that have addressed royalty, but it's a very common conception that at end of field life or when basins are very mature, that there's different royalty accommodations from the landowner's perspective, because, you know, royalty is the owner's share. And as you get to the end of life and you may expect development not to proceed unless there's more competitive terms. And so historically, whether it's for end of life fields or new fields, there's been these kinds of royalty inducements that have seen success in bringing fields online. And so we think that in a broader perspective, it's an appropriate step now.
Yeah, quick follow-up, and then I'm going to change topics, Mr. Kutcher. Yeah, through the chair. So you have a captive audience. You have a captive market, basically, which is the domestic demand in South Central. There is no other source of gas, I think, that I can see that is economical for them to be able to pursue. If they were to import LNG, it's not even feasible to import LNG because you have no facility that could take liquefied natural gas currently. So again, if the price at the point of sale, let's say, doubled, and that is still more economical than the alternative, I still don't quite understand how knocking a 12% royalty off the point of production would matter. But my question is just going to be, if the price is floating and you see no interest in producers developing this resource, I guess why would it be the only logical conclusion to draw that you'd have to give royalty relief? Because to me, that you might be inserting a perverse incentive, because if the market demand and the price point at the point of sale is not incentive enough, if that price is floating upwards constantly to get the value of margin for a producer, then it kind of begs the question that, you know, maybe the resource is more lucrative for the producer than we think it is, right? Because, again, if I'm buying gas currently at $10 and they're market price is going to be 20 and they're still not producing, then what difference, I guess, would the royalty percent that's fractional make?
Representative Stapp, through the chair, if I understand the question correctly, from the department's perspective and the administration's perspective, the royalty is a fixed term through the contracts that governs the term of the potential development of our resource. And so it's directly within the state's control, and in the current framework, we're not seeing the development of the resource. Now, price is a huge part of the revenue input, which governs project economics, which governs project sanction. But from our perspective, action on the royalty is what the state can do to incentivize and push forward these developments. We've seen it work on project-specific royalty reductions in other scenarios. We've seen it work on general royalty reductions in Cook Inlet for new fields and platforms, or for platforms at their end of life. And so we think that's an appropriate action for the state to take to lower the royalty to try and get these resources online. Now, we at the department can't speak for the broader pricing decisions, you know, as consumers, as sellers of gas, or for all the different things that go into that. But as you can imagine, the price terms being offered are, I would say, sticky. There's not a, you know, live exchange of gas. There's individual negotiations with individual consumers, with individual buyers, individual producers. And so as the market equivalates to this new reality, we do probably expect to see prices change. A great deal of the gas for consumers and utilities today is under contract at set prices. And so the market's ability to respond and indicate to these, respond to these price potentialities is not totally fluid and perfect. And that kind of goes to the timeliness aspect, where we want to bring forward legislation today that makes these projects more competitive, sees them sanctioned as soon as this year, and in response gets consumers gas, rather than waiting for a year or two for negotiations to proceed, and then a year or two for prices to adjust, et cetera. So,
Representative Stapp?
Yep, thank you, Chair Foster. This will be my last line of questioning, I'm fairly certain, through the chair. So you mentioned the contracts are at a set price and they vary by, let's call it, the end user, in this case the utilities. Why not simply just rebate the royalty directly to the end user? And that way, when contract negotiations come up, that in itself is negotiating power. Does that make sense? So, like, if I'm going to collect my 12.5% royalty and I'm using it for domestic gas usage anyways, it doesn't really make that whole lot of sense that the state would, let's create an artificial, price that its own people are going to pay for the gas, right? So if you're looking to incentivize something, you could rebate the royalty to the utilities who are negotiating the contract, therefore take it out of the scale. I mean, wouldn't that have the same effect?
Representative Stapp, through the chair, I think you're absolutely right that the royalty assessments on gas that are sold to in-state users are thus, you know, paid for by those in-state end users. And so that's, you know, what dynamic informing this bill and informing our cost discussion, you know, the price in the market. I very much agree with you on that. I think how the legislature determines to allocate royalties received from the resource is very much a valid policy question. There may be very reasonable and appropriate ways to look at programs where those royalties are used for specific purposes, including consumer rebates. This legislation doesn't have that. We believe this is focused on the kind of dynamics of getting projects sanctioned and approved and getting the development started, but that could very naturally be a policy discussion for the legislature.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I've got a quick question, and we'll go to Representative Galvin, Representative Hannon. You can incentivize natural gas production through reducing royalties. We've also already reduced taxes, production taxes on natural gas, which I believe are near zero already. Can you remind me what exactly the production tax on natural gas in Cook Inlet is?
Chair Foster, I believe Dan Stickle from the Department of Revenue is online, and your characterization, I believe, is correct, but he'll be able to inform us specifically.
Thank you. Mr. Dan Stickle, if you're online, can you put yourself on the record?
Yeah, this is Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. Could you repeat the question, please?
Yes, Mr. Stickle, I was just wanting to point out that what this bill does is it, we're trying to incentivize natural gas production through the reduction of the royalty rate down to zero. And I just wanted to kind of try to put things in perspective and just mention that we've already reduced the tax rate on production for natural gas in the Cook Inlet. Prior legislatures have done that. And just wanted to kind of get a recap. I believe it's near zero. It's pretty low. Can you just kind of give us a brief summary of what that is?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the production tax for gas in Cook Inlet applies to taxable gas, which is basically what's left over after taking the royalty. So a reduction in state royalty would slightly increase the volume of taxable gas that is subject to tax. The current gas production tax in Cook Inlet is 13% of gross value. However, there is a tax ceiling that applies. That tax ceiling varies for each of the different fields. The average is between 15 and 16 cents per 1,000 cubic feet for any new fields that were to come in to line, come online, that tax ceiling would be 17.7 cents per 1,000 cubic feet. And so our revenue forecast, accounting for those tax ceilings, we're forecasting $7 million of total production tax from Cook Inlet in fiscal year 2025 and $8 million for fiscal year 2026. Mm. So fairly small production tax revenues due to that tax ceiling. And then the potential tax impacts of House Bill 223 would be basically to the extent that there's slightly less royalty gas, there would be slightly more taxable gas subject to the production tax with those tax ceilings. And then if the bill is successful in incenting new production, that new production would pay at the 17.7 cents per 1,000 cubic feet tax ceiling.
Great. Thank you very much. And like I said, I just wanted to point out that on the production side for tax, natural gas tax rates, it's pretty small. I think you mentioned the total revenue is about $7 million. And so anyway, this would be the other part of trying to incentivize, and that's on this royalty side. So with that, we'll go over to Representative Galvin, then Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, I was just thinking about Representative Stepp's comments and answers, and I wondered how DNR would feel about an amendment that limited the guaranteed length of royalty relief to, let's say, 5 years instead of 10. And then it would also give DNR the authority to extend it if the economics justified it at that time. And I say that kind of keeping in mind, I know this is a very complex decision to be thinking about, but I ask the question because I remember from a multi-day training with Rich Ruggiero last summer, where they talked about how difficult it was in the first 5 years and that it's really important to, if our goal is to drive in players to this field, and I think Cook Inlet in particular, then you're supposed to, my understanding is, you look at what, and I'm looking at this graph on page 10, where, when it starts coming in, ideally, given what information you have, it looks like it's closer to, 4 or 5 years, and they're making money. They shouldn't be losing. I know we're already accepting quite a lot of risk if they end up with some dry holes, right? I mean, we're already taking a risk, and I guess I'm just curious to know how you would feel about something like that, where you look at the numbers at that point, 5 years in.
Representative Galvin, through the chair, you know, the department would be happy to work with different conceptual or policy amendments with the committee. I would say, you know, without taking a definitive position that we do or do not support that concept, I would note that we have the perspective that we need action now that is highly visible and certain for project developers to sanction and take action on projects. And that having a framework with a set period without further kind of steps or analysis, and having that period be sufficient for there to be robust returns, you know, within the time frame of this market, I think we all anticipate that 10, 15 years from now, rail belt energy supplies may have very different sourcing or diversity of sourcing. And so I think we view further analyses or shorter periods as rebalancing the legislation away from being highly likely to incentivize projects. And so we'd want to just make that, depending on what specifically was proposed, we want to make that analysis for the committee. And, you know, I think it's a policy that we keep coming back to, that we don't want to work too hard to save ourselves $1 million or $2 from an additional analysis and not have a new field sanctioned and thus have major supply limitations, whether it's in 5 years, 8 years, or whenever. So I'm happy to discuss that with the committee, but I think we want the legislation to be clearly applicable and be clearly understandable for project developers.
Well, I don't think that's very good, pardon me, through the chair. Seems to me that's not a super complicated, if I can come up with, I mean, I'm, I don't know what to say. But I think it's something maybe for you to take back and talk about, because I'm talking about in 5 years, if it's justifiable, because you're looking at the economics, then you extend it the extra 5 years, for example. I mean, that's something that can be written in with the stroke of a hand, you know, a minute or two. And so I just, you know, food for thought in looking at the numbers, and I understand you want to be incentivizing and ensure you're putting out some carrots. But what I learned from Rich Ruggiero is that would be a carrot. That'd be a nice carrot from what, now maybe I misunderstood him, but I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And my question is actually for you, spurred by Representative Josephson's question and then DNR's response. And I am wondering how we as the committee would request both alleged legal opinion. You know, when House Bill 223 was drafted, there could have been alleged legal opinion raising a concern about the lawsuit with royalty reduction from 87, but the sponsor's under no obligation to share that with us. And I would like to see us request one from Ledge Legal, and the same with the Attorney General's office. And, you know, the Attorney General's office is under no obligation to share an opinion about a bill with us that might have raised legal questions. But if we're trying to resolve a Cook Inlet Gas and there's any question about legal constraints of the guardrails, whether it can be reduced to zero or not, lingering from that 1987 decision, I'd like to know it before we move it on, instead of fumbling later of thinking we have a solution and finding there's pending, you know, we've opened ourselves up to litigation that prevents it from going forward. And I don't know how to go about that, Mr. Chair. Because I'm not the sponsor of the bill, and I have no authority to ask the Attorney General's, but I guess I could just ask Ledge Legal on the drafting.
That's a good question. I think, you know, my office, we can certainly reach out to both entities and see how far we can get. I had planned to set amendment deadline, but I think it is a worthy question, and so maybe we'll just hold off on that for now, and maybe as much as possible try to get somewhere, and if we can't get anywhere, at least we've tried. So we'll do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Are there any other questions? Okay, Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair
Foster, through the chair. So this is looks pretty good for South Central. And, you know, I represent a district in Fairbanks. Also want to look at the state, you know, as a whole. But I also need to represent my district. And currently, I just heard from the CEO of Golden Valley, which is a member-owned utility. Obviously, the Fairbanks community owns that utility. Well, we're going to see another almost 5% increase in our kilowatt hours for electric use, which is going to, I don't know what the end total is going to be, but we're going to be running over 30 cents per kilowatt hour. This seems to me, I want to know, how is this going to help Fairbanks, you know, considering our cheapest electric that we get comes out of Bradley Lake, which we own about 18% of. But when that energy, the electricity comes up through the intertie, which I just saw in this previous presentation that AEA owns the intertie, but we still get hit with all kinds of increases, tariffs, taxes, postage stamp increases to our electric cost as it gets to Fairbanks. And considering the fact that we only have 2,400 customers that use gas in Fairbanks, so most of us heat with diesel fuel, which currently is about at $4.50 delivered price, which is considerably higher than gas in the area. I think we have a break-even point of about $3.07 in comparison for natural gas heating to diesel fuel heating. So we're 50% higher for our heating needs in Fairbanks also. So I need to understand and how we can formulate this in a way that it can not only help South Central, but it also helps the Fairbanks area, which includes, you know, everything that Golden Valley, Delta, you know, and all these other adjoining areas. How is this going to help the interior?
Yeah. Mr. Crother?
Representative Tomaszewski, through the chair, I think that's very critical concern for energy policy on a statewide level. And, you know, the interior is critical from a military readiness from perspective, from an infrastructure development perspective, from enabling North Slope activity. You know, it's an industrial core in Fairbanks and the broader area there. And energy is one of the huge, most significant challenges. So certainly understand those concerns and considerations. You know, we believe this bill directly influences the energy markets in Fairbanks in two ways, but then there's also several other important considerations that you referenced that are not directly affected by this bill. So we don't want to represent that this is a cure-all for that broader energy policy transmission development, transmission access question. But Cook Inlet Natural Gas, a small portion of it has historically gone into the interior for the IGU system for that direct natural gas use. Now there is a startup of the North Slope facility to truck LNG down into the interior. And so there's a diversity of supply away from Cook Inlet for some of these same market reasons, as I understand it. There's also electricity that's wheeled up to Fairbanks through the intertie that's generated from Cook Inlet gas. And so I think that the availability and supply security for that gas leading to energy reliability for Fairbanks is maybe the most direct impact of this bill. That is as affected as you noted by transmission, both the rates assessed for that and the capacity of that transmission. And that's not something that this legislation addresses. There is other legislation by the administration that DNR is not expert on, so I don't want to speak to the details and fumble them, but we do believe this has important impacts for the interior, but we very much understand that there's that broader conversation with other pieces of an energy efforts needs to take into consideration the extremely high costs that you're seeing today and hopefully at some point in the future will not see due to expanded infrastructure and access.
Follow-up. Follow-up.
So, yeah, that's through the chair. Thank you. I understand we do get some direct electricity through the intertie from gas production, gas generation in Anchorage area. And we are now going to be starting trucking from the slope, and our price of gas is going to be considerably lower from the slope, but the overall cost is actually going to increase just through the cost of the liquefaction and also the trucking distance. We're actually going to see quite a significant increase in the gas price delivered to Fairbanks coming from the slope versus coming from Cook Inlet source. So how can we balance that in a way that will help the Fairbanks area?
Yeah, Representative Tomaszewski, I think that's a very, very critical question. One of the, so that gas supply cost, as you referenced, is very competitive on the slope, which is a great thing. There is a small state royalty component to that gas, like there is with Cook Inlet gas today. The capital costs associated with the facility build out and then the transportation costs are the key drivers there. So that is a hard cost for the Department of Natural Resources to directly influence. But I do think the continued state interest in the build out of the IGU network helps spread that cost across a broader consumer base. So that's one potential solution there. But take your point that's an important consideration as the Interior works to diversify their supply solutions, looking towards longer-term energy supplies, just like Cook Inlet is looking at in a longer-term sense. That cost is a critical consideration. But we think this bill, as proposed and as before the committee, doesn't directly impact the economics of that trucking supply for the Interior.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. We will figure out the legal opinion issue and reset the amendment deadline maybe in the next day or two. So with that, if there are no further questions on that, just want to kind of give a idea of our moving forward plan. We've got about a month left in session. We'd like to try to push as many House bills over to the Senate as we can over the next 3 weeks. So we'll probably be moving to as many two-a-day meetings as we can. We overall will be looking at just bills overall, but maybe with a little more of a focus on the energy side. We also have the education bill that is now in House Finance, so looking at maybe putting that up next week. We will, after that 3 weeks, over the next 3 weeks, that we're focusing on bills as much as we can. After that, the House will be going into conference committee with the Senate, so we'll be looking at the 24-hour rule, which means that things are going to be moving pretty quickly. So I just wanted to give folks a sense of kind of the pace of, what we'll be doing. And so with that, tomorrow, our meeting is at 10 a.m. And at that meeting, we'll be hearing House Bill 111, which is Education for Deaf and Hearing Impaired. And then in the afternoon, we're scheduled for a 1:30 meeting, and we'll hear House Bill 393, which is Cook Inlet and Middle Earth Gas Royalties, as well as House Bill 307, which is Integrated Transmission Systems. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll be adjourned at 3:43 p.m. Thanks.